Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to the Vietnamese podcast. I have my co-host John Phan today. We are still trying to figure out this the title, but right now the working title is Ancient Vietnam, but that's to change. I think we're still working on that. We're on our, fourth episode together.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Today, we're going to talk about this idea of literary Vietnamese. And, you know, it's a contentious topic in my mind, and it's always been because of the relationship to China and to Chinese. But before we get into all of that, it took you a while to arrive at all the information, and I just want to put the word out there about donating to the YouTube episode that we have this on.
Yes, thank you so much. Please do. You know, if you're interested in this content, you find it interesting, please help us out a little bit. Every tiny bit helps. So please do donate if you have the chance. Thanks.
Thank you, John. So let's get to it. This idea that Vietnamese, our language, derived from Vietnam, from Chinese, has been in the last two episodes we've talked till we're blue in the face about its real origins. But today we're going to talk about the written language. So let's get started.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked a lot about the nature of the spoken languages, especially Vietnamese, and the influence of Chinese on the Vietnamese language. I just want to repeat again, especially for new visitors, Vietnamese is not genealogically related to Chinese, but has a lot of influence. If you are new to the series and you want to learn more about that, please listen to our previous two episodes or pick up my book, Lost Tongues of the Red River. Shameless, I know. But there's a whole other part of the story, and that is not what are Vietnamese people speaking or how is the spoken Vietnamese language influenced by China, but what about the written language? What did Vietnamese people write all the way throughout history? And that's very complicated. It's complicated because writing is very different than speaking. Writing, script, the capacity to write, one should think about it as a technology. And in fact, most scholars believe that the technology of writing in the history of humankind has only been invented maybe four times. And then of those four inventions, it just spread to every other society on earth. So that means that there are only four societies who invented writing for specifically the language that they speak. Now, there are some exceptions to that general rule, but for the vast majority of human societies, a society will take a script, a writing system, from another society and adapt it for their own purposes. And sometimes it takes a long time before they change that writing script. And for many centuries, they might be writing, in fact, in a language that's not anywhere near to the language that they speak. And this is the case for Vietnam. For most of Vietnamese history, not just the first 1,000 years that we've talked a lot about, but all the way up even until the 20th century, the primary vehicle for written expression was a form of Chinese that in English we sometimes call classical Chinese, but a better term is literary Chinese or literary Sinitic. And in Vietnamese, we tend to just call it Du Han, which is literally Han characters or Chinese characters. But the better term is Văn Ngôn or Han Văn. Either Văn Ngôn literally means the literary language. Văn học, ngôn là ngôn ngữ. And then Han Văn is the language of the Han language. So what we want to talk about today is the history of the use of Văn Ngôn or Han Văn in the long history of Vietnam.
John, before you go on, I'd like to ask you about the four different languages, the raw, I guess they're just the raw languages that popped up. Can you tell me about, maybe not go into detail, but just where are those four, where they come from?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I teach a class on the history of writing in East Asia, and we start with this. It's fascinating to me. So, you know, again, it's not without controversy. And this is slightly outside my field because I don't work on most of these languages. But most scholars believe that the four inventions of writing in the history of humankind are, first, something called cuneiform, which is invented by the ancient Sumerians. If you watch Ancient Aliens, you've probably heard of them. So that's the first, and that's the oldest invention of writing. And then the second probably happened very shortly thereafter, but most scholars believe at least semi-independently, if not completely independently, is ancient Egyptian writing in the form originally of hieroglyphs and then later on hieratic and then ultimately Coptic. So Egyptian hieroglyphs is the second invention. So let me get to the other two before I tell you the adaptation. So the third invention in the history of humankind is, in fact, the Chinese. The ancient Chinese invented independently ancient Chinese writing sometime maybe in the second millennium BC, maybe older, maybe earlier than that. But we have surviving examples of that ancient form of writing from at least about 1700 BC in the form of oracle bones with the ancient Chinese script on it. So virtually all the scripts and forms of writing in East Asia, including Vietnam, with the exception of modern alphabet, derives from this ancient Chinese, and by Chinese, I want to put scare quotes on that, invention of writing. And then the fourth invention of writing is the independent invention of writing in the New World by the Maya, the ancient Maya. So ancient Maya also has a form of writing. Wow. So those are the main four inventions of writing.
And where did English come from? Where did the Romanic language alphabets come from?
Yes, excellent question. So this is a little bit controversial as far as I understand. Again, not my expertise, but I spend a lot of hours reading and watching videos about this. But so the classic understanding is that we use the Latin alphabet both in Vietnam and in English, right? And that's a good example of how writing and speaking are independent of one another. The Latin alphabet and the Greek alphabet are related, and they were originally adaptations of an alphabet used by the ancient Phoenicians. The Phoenicians are a Semitic people related to ancient Hebrews and Arabs living in sort of the Eastern Mediterranean. And the Phoenician alphabet was itself an adaptation of a sort of cursivized form of ancient Egyptian writing. So in fact, most of the scripts of the world that are derived from or related to Latin script or Greek script, that includes Cyrillic, that includes most of the scripts of Europe, are derived from Phoenician and ultimately from ancient Egyptian. The reason why that's a little controversial is that we have discovered some very, very, very ancient Semitic alphabets that pose the question of whether or not this is actually derived from Egyptian. But most scholars, I think, still believe that that they are derived from ancient Egyptian. And the easiest way to think about it, actually, you can just do a quick Google search, that the letter A or alpha or alf, you know, it's the same in, for example, Hebrew, Arabic, Greek, Latin, etc. That is, if you rotate it, essentially, if you take the English A and you rotate it like upside down, you can see that it originally came from a picture of a cow with horns. And that was an ancient Egyptian hieroglyph with the pronunciation value of, it was kind of like a glottal. So that turned into the letter A. Wow. In all of these other scripts. So yeah, it's pretty interesting that if the scholars are right about this, almost all the scripts in Western Europe are derived ultimately from ancient Egyptian.
This is insane like information, because I think that if you just become a linguistics major in college, you basically get to study sociology, history, language, political thought. I mean, you can pack everything on just by the history and tracking the development, the evolution of letters and history, because everything boils down to these four forms. And It's pretty mind-blowing to me.
It's crazy. Yeah. And I mean, linguistics as a field, actually, linguistics doesn't care about writing. Like writing, the history of writing is kind of a separate field.
Wow.
But I think this shows us, as you're saying, all of these phenomena, these human phenomena, writing, language, and then history, sociology, these things are all intertwined. There is no language without understanding, you know, the humans involved, you know, and there is no understanding, for example, human history without understanding the function of language and how language operates as a system.
Can we go back and make an argument that without any written, this is such an ignorant thing to say, but these people without a written form, arguably, I mean, did we have our own thought? If we couldn't actually have it in written form, we were just sort of mumbling words, and then the Chinese come in. So like, where does that put the original Vietnamese people in terms of literacy?
This is a great question. And it's like a super important question when we talk about language versus writing or language and writing. So the first thing to note, so what you just said, that story you just told, you know, like, oh, we were just wandering around in the dark and we were just mumbling. I've heard that too. And that is the imperial Sinitic story, you know, like the Sinitic or Chinese empires, their story of colonization is always that story. Like we are bringing light to these people who don't have light. And that is, to be perfectly frank, it is a colonizing story. It's a story to justify conquest by force. But, you know, and in fact, even the word gnome, you know, the one that we'll talk about gnome in a future episode. I know everyone wants to hear about gnome this episode, but you got to tune into the next episode because it'll be one more. But even gnome, the character for gnome and gnome has a ko on the left, and then it's the character for cell. That word gnome means gnome means to mumble, like to mumble. So one way to understand the oldest word name for the Vietnamese script was the mumbling script. So that's a story that's told by people at the top. Now, what about the actual answer? Like, what were Vietnamese or Vietic peoples like before writing? So the first thing you need to recognize that's really important to keep in your mind is that language is the kind of evolutionary leap. Like, language is in some ways what makes us human. And so much, like the fundamental capacity for thinking and things like that is maybe tied to language. But writing is not of the same nature. Writing is an amplifier. It's a technology that amplifies. Yeah. So you can think about it like the iPhone. Like the iPhone gives you an amazing capacity to do and to record and to organize and things like that. But it doesn't give you the fundamental capacity to think, right? I mean, AI is a whole different topic, yeah. But traditional technologies like that are amplifiers, and writing is just like that. So writing does not bestow the capacity to think critically or to form hierarchical thought. Language is something that maybe is tied to that, though that's difficult. But that is a linguistic thing. But writing can amplify those things. So certainly, in societies that acquire writing, it's like a society acquiring metallurgy or a society acquiring some other really, really powerful technology. Once a society acquires it, they're capable of doing much more because they can form records, they can make long distance communication, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it does, but you're not less human if you don't have writing. And you right. can, there are many societies in the world that became incredibly advanced without the full benefits of fully fledged writing systems. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that I have to acknowledge that some people have argued that the Đông Sơn, you know, we should do another episode on Đông Sơn, or perhaps you've done one with Professor Nam Kim, who is an expert on that era. But
yeah,
the Đông Sơn, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, we've done it, but he and I have talked about the earth, the records in the earth, but the Đông Sơn era in the literary side would be definitely a great addition to that kind of research.
Yeah, so there is this question of whether the Đông Sơn had writing. And, you know, if you know anything about the Đông Sơn, you know that they had this incredible rich iconography on the drums particularly, but also on the weaponry, on the axe heads and the spearheads. And there are two baskets of ideas out there. One is that, well, if they were capable of this, then they must have had a writing system and it just doesn't survive because maybe it was on palm leaves or some other perishable item. That is, for me, 100% possible because, you know, we don't know what survives. It's totally possible that the Nome Sun had some form of writing that does not survive. If that's true, we have to ask ourselves why they never inscribed anything with that writing. Like, you know, because typically writing is precious, so you would inscribe it on things like stone and metal. Also, one should say that the Nome Sun, just because they have this incredibly advanced bronze culture, does not mean that they have to have had writing. There are many examples of civilizations in the history of the world, as I said a moment ago, that achieve high levels of sophistication in many different technological areas, but never develop writing. You know, so that logic is not sound. It's totally possible, but it's also totally possible that it's not true. And then there's a group of people that are like, well, the iconography itself is writing, mm-hmm. you know, like the figures,
yep.
that's a form of writing that we have not cracked yet. To them, I would say, well, crack it then. If it is a form of writing, then decipher it, you know, because writing is not iconography. Writing is a very specific thing, which is a system of discrete units that are reorganized to represent natural language.
Okay.
So when you look at a sign like a skull and crossbones, and you know that means this is poisonous or this is dangerous, that is not a form of writing. That is a kind of iconography, right? So for writing to be fully fledged, it has to actually represent language, which means you should be able to read it. So the iconography of the Nome Sun may be meaningful. It might be expressing deep messages of culture, even, you know, actual specific messaging about, you know, different cultural things. But that does not mean it's writing, okay? So I am very skeptical of the idea that Nome Sun iconography is in any way a form of fully fledged writing.
You know, when I listen to you explain iconography as it relates to language, and that there are people out there arguing it, is it like professional level people, like academics that are arguing that or is it sort of like the general public who have an opinion about it? And like, they're like, no, this is just a very early basic form of communication through cranes and all of these things that are on the drums. But is it like at the professional grade? Because I think the argument is very clear to me.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So I think this might be a better question for Professor Nam Kim. As far as I understand, there has not been any real credible peer-reviewed attempt to argue that Nome Sun iconography is a form of writing. It is, once again, our favorite word in this subseries. It is in more of the jianzao kind of space. Mm-hmm. And I tend to feel like Nome Sun is a very it's as emotional as the question of Vietnamese language, right? Because for modern Vietnamese people today, starting from the 19th century or so, the Nome Sun, or really the 20th century, the Nome Sun are our quote unquote ancestors. And that we, you know, we should have another episode about that belief itself, you know. But for that reason, I think because many Vietnamese people truly believe that, then they want the Nome Sun to have this super advanced pre-Chinese civilization. And that means they must have, you know, had writing. But as we've talked about, there's very little actual evidence for that. I should also add, as I mentioned a couple episodes ago, we don't even know if the Nome Sun peoples even spoke a language related to Vietnamese, right? That's also not proven.
John, I need to make a little tangent here and get your opinion about this idea that you bring up and that I think about often, is that when we experience this idea of the French, the Chinese bringing quote unquote light into our culture and shine these technologies into the early Vietnamese, but aren't they doing us a favor? No, I'm going to argue on both sides of this because obviously nobody wants to be colonized and enslaved and then put to forced labor, right? Nobody wants that in their history. Nobody wants to be the labor side and have an elite group of people come in and just control the entire place to make money and right. But at the same time, I deal with this idea in my head that, well, without the Chinese and the French architecture, language, all these things, I mean, can't we make an argument for them coming in to stir the pot up a little bit and brought these wonderful gifts to these people? Oh, yeah, this is going to sound really bad, but like we were in the jungle, right? I mean, we lived, this idea of like bringing light into the jungle is a real thing. And I bring this up because I want people who exist in that space in the conservative mindset and saying, rah, rah, America, America, look at what they did. There's these arguments that I think go all the way back in history to this argument.
I think, you know, you're posing a question that many people are afraid to pose because of political correctness, you know, and I think it's brave and it's actually important to pose this question. I think the answer is very complicated. So the first answer is, as you already noted, we cannot speak of intentions because for the most part, the intent, no matter what the sort of cultural propaganda is about spreading culture, that's the kind of Confucian propaganda in pre-modern times. Certainly, there's a lot of evidence that for 9 out of 10 times, the intent is conquest and then resource extraction. You know, so that is what they're there for. You know, maybe they teach people to read and write so that they can bill them, you know, and same with the French. Maybe the French built an incredible road system for Vietnam, but they did not build that to benefit Vietnam as much as they did to cart away things like rubber and things like other resources back to the metropole, you know. So there's a great argument. I mean, I would never, you know, I mean, that said, there are individuals who might have actually believed in the moral cause. But overall, humans are humans, and conquest is generally exploitative in its intent and its reality. The second thing to note is that in the opposite direction, as you're saying, even though conquest is exploitative, there are always side effects to it. And the spread of technology is a side effect, you know? And the spread of technology does have this incredible potential for advancement because, you know, if you are a one society conquering another and you have advanced tools to help you conquer, of course, the spread of those tools to the conquered is going to have the potential of benefiting the conquered. And we can think about writing in that way. Writing is a technology of the conqueror. But once the conqueror conquered the area of the Red River, that technology spread to the Red River to incredible benefit of the peoples of the Red River. And we'll talk about the complicated way that was realized, maybe the rest of this discussion. But before we do, I want to make one last point. And I think back on the other side, when we think about this and we think about, for example, because we're going to talk about how much Chinese writing is a part of Vietnamese identity and Vietnamese culture.
Right.
You know, that's one of the things I want to really get across today.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I think is right to mourn, is right to grieve for, is what could have been. So I always think of this scene. I'm going to get in trouble for mentioning this. Well, but there's a scene in this movie, Kundun. This movie, maybe I even mentioned it once in this podcast, but it's a movie about the Dalai Lama and about the conquest of Tibet by the PRC. And one of the last scenes, they make this argument as well, like, oh, well, China is modernizing Tibet. But at the end of that film, the Dalai Lama says, the tragedy, I'm paraphrasing, but the tragedy is we were about to do it ourselves. We were about to do it ourselves. And it reminds me in turn of this very famous book in Vietnamese studies called Lost Modernities. Now, I won't get into the contents of that book or that collection, but the idea there is that we'll never know what the Đông Xuân culture would have looked like as a modern sophisticated culture because it was obliterated, it was conquered, you know? And that's a kind of loss. I'm not to say that Vietnamese people are the descendants of the Đông Xuân, but because there was this event where the Chinese came, the Han came in and conquered the area and essentially obliterated Đông Xuân, who knows what the Đông Xuân would have been like had they been allowed to flourish on their own, acquire technologies on their own. And when we think about a situation like Native American peoples in the United States. That's a powerful argument on the side of the Native American, different Native American nations, because they never had the chance to develop into modernity without the intervention, without the conquest of the European powers. So it's a great pain for them to imagine what could it have been like, you know, what might it have been like. So we have to keep that in mind when we now turn to what actually happened and how integrated, you know, the Sinitic or the Chinese language and writing system are in our now identity, because there is a thing that could have been that never will be, you know? So I think it's important to remember.
Thank you for that. Those are sort of beautiful ideas of these mysteries that are never going to be unlocked. Yeah. And I think that's the sad part about it. But yeah, thank you for breaking that down, because, you know, it's something that exists, I think, in the Vietnamese community, in the modern Vietnamese community throughout. It's like, well, you know, so many people are into French music. This certain period of French music and sort of like the Belle Epoque of French music. And every time I hear it, it triggers me.
Oh.
it triggers me because I'm like, hold up, you know, like,
yeah,
this is some.
I got it.
Yeah, yeah. And so here we are.
Yeah, but let me say two things in roots, because this is such a good issue. Like, one, I want to say, like, the thing, the other thing to mention is that the thing that we think of as the imperial culture, like Chinese culture or French culture or whatever, like, we always forget how much of that culture, that dominant culture, is in fact the result of all these conquered peoples or all these assimilated peoples contributing to what that culture actually comes to be. You know, a great example of that is America. You know, so much of American culture comes from Black America. And of course, Black America were enslaved people. They started as enslaved peoples. You know, so you cannot be like, oh, these conquerors are the light bearers. And that's, you know, they invented this high culture. But in fact, any imperial culture is indebted deeply to all the different constituents of that imperial identity. And when we think about Sinitic culture, side note, that's why I tend to call it Sinitic and not Chinese. Please look at our pilot episode before the subseries began. If you look at Sinitic culture, places like the Red River, places like what will become Vietnam, were major contributors to what became Sinitic culture. And that's why I don't like it when we just call Han culture, Tang culture, all these different ancient Sinitic cultures, quote unquote, Chinese, because it robs us of our ownership of that identity and our contributions to that identity. So it's important to remember.
Love it.
So, you know, that's a good segue to actually the specific question is, okay, where does writing and literacy come from in the history of Vietnam? So if we set aside the question of Đồng Sơn, you know, writing comes with the Sinitic conquest. By Sinitic conquest, we're talking about the Han Empire, the Han Dynasty, conquering the area of the Red River in the first couple centuries, the last couple centuries BC. But really, the major time when the Sinitic peoples really settle in the area of the Red River is around the time of the Tung Sisters Rebellion. So that's a very famous, Hai Ba Tung is a very famous couple of ladies who raised a rebellion against the Han colonizers. And that rebellion famously failed. They were killed along with hundreds and hundreds of their followers, essentially wiping out what was probably the Đồng Sơn aristocracy, probably the pre-Sinitic aristocracy of the region, replacing it with a hybridized local Han sort of ruling elite. But this is when Han culture becomes really embedded in the area. And of course, what are the Han peoples writing? They're writing in a language we now call Han Văn or Văn Ngôn. I'm going to call it for the rest of this episode Văn Ngôn or Literary Sinitic. Okay. One thing I want to emphasize is that already, even as early as the Han Dynasty, again, we're now like first century, you know, like CE, that language is already very different, even for a Chinese, a Han person, even for a person from the north of modern day China. Already, when they write, it's quite different from what they speak. So now imagine you're in the Red River Plain around Hanoi. You've got Sinitic peoples, Han peoples living there now, having families, maybe marrying local people, having children, and they speak maybe both a form of Chinese, shout out to our previous episode, as well as maybe a form of Vedic language. So whether they speak Chinese or not, when they learn to write, it's going to be a language that's very different from what they speak. And that's hard for us to wrap our minds around because we live in a world, especially in America, where what we speak is close to what we write.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's pretty close. But for most of history, that's just not the case. In fact, for most of history, what you learn to write is just totally different from what you speak. Just it's literally a different language. Maybe it's a related to your spoken language and maybe not, but either way, your spoken language almost doesn't help you. Maybe it helps you only very little to learn that written language. So that's the scenarios. And this is where I want to introduce the concept of cosmopolitan versus vernacular language. So what is a cosmopolitan language? A cosmopolitan language is a language that transcends boundaries, it transcends regions, because it can be written down, because it has a writing system that people are trained to use to learn how to read and write that language. And therefore, it tends to become the official language of states, of empires. For example, in the Western world, the classic example is Latin. Latin was the language of the Roman Empire, right? So Romans would write in Latin, and then if you were conquered by the Romans, you learn how to write in Latin. And, you know, Rome conquered Western Europe and replaced a lot of the languages that were spoken in Western Europe. But for much of Roman history, you might speak some language. You might speak Gaulish if you were in the area of modern-day France, which is a Germanic language. But if you were upwardly mobile in the Roman Empire, you would learn how to write Latin because that would gain you access to upward mobility. You could rise in the ranks of the empire. And so Latin becomes this cosmopolitan language that's learned, you learn to read and write because you're part of this cosmopolitan sort of system, cultural system.
The same thing. Eerily similar to French and Vietnamese in the 50s. It's so scary.
Exactly. And I mean, so cosmopolitan languages are typically imperial languages. So the French Empire, of course, the cosmopolitan language was French. So we can see the remnants of that empire today in the Francophone world. You know, we see places like Niger, you know, Algeria, Morocco, but also, you know, the remnants of French-speaking Vietnam, also Quebec, all these places where French was the administrative cosmopolitan language, you know? And of course, the most powerful example of that in the modern world is the Anglophone world. You know, English is such a powerful language today because it was and continues to be a cosmopolitan language. Mm. And the key idea here is that those cosmopolitan languages exist alongside your vernacular language, the language of the locale, the language of the region that is typically spoken. So take a place like any place in India, right? Like you speak your local language, and then you maybe also speak English because it's the cosmopolitan language. And also, of course, today you maybe also speak Hindi because that's the cosmopolitan language of India, you know? So in Vietnam, same thing today. Maybe you are Thai. Your local language is the Thai language, but you speak Vietnamese and you read and write Vietnamese because now Vietnamese is the kind of local cosmopolitan language of the Vietnamese state, you know? So this concept is really important for understanding the history of literary Sinitic or Văn Ngôn in Vietnam, because you want to think of there being a literary language or a official language that is cosmopolitan, and that is used alongside the vernacular language or languages that are spoken on a daily basis. And then we will complicate that eventually because the vernacular language, when it becomes powerful enough, becomes a kind of cosmopolitan. but we'll get to that later. Yeah.
I have so many questions that are so unrelated to the direction we're headed.
That's okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like I think about hip hop. I think about, you know.
Great example. Yeah.
It just comes to mind. I'm like, okay. In certain.
Hip hop is my favorite. Yeah. So hip hop is my favorite example to use when explaining the vernacular and the cosmopolitan. But go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at what point are we in a place where, I don't know. I mean, this idea of Ebonics vernacular and being, for example, there's this thing called, you know, like Black Hollywood, right? So
yeah,
if you're at a party in Hollywood and it's all just like an entirely Black, you know, group of people, and it's all producers, actors like Will Smith and all these big names in like Kevin Hart, they, and then they all show up and just, you know, show up to this party. There's like 1,000 people and they rent out a stadium, you know, in downtown LA or, you know, and it's really the powerful language of hip hop. You see Jamie Foxx, you see all these people, but they're not speaking they're not speaking like British English. They're not speaking proper American English. They're speaking their own. It's a beautiful, you know, Black English.
Mm-hmm.
So when does that transfer over to becoming the sort of from vernacular to cosmopolitan?
It's so great to pose that question because, you know, now there is a kind of cosmopolitan Black American English, you know, that was popularized through hip hop culture. But when you think about it, that dialect itself, that form of language itself originated, first of all, hip hop originated in the Bronx in New York, but Bronx dialect Black English is very specific. There's Michigan African-American vernacular. There's Mississippi African-American vernacular. There's so many different vernaculars of African-American English. And then there's the Bronx. So, you know, each, even within the Black community, there's enormous vernacular diversity. And then one of those cultures rises up and starts to create this incredibly dynamic culture that, and the key here is that then gains enormous prestige. It becomes so popular. It spreads even across, even beyond Black communities. And it becomes itself a kind of cosmopolitan because now it is a language and a mode and a style that is embraced and performed by many, many different peoples outside of, you know, the couple of Bronx neighborhoods where it started, you know? So that in that sense, it's cosmopolitan. But in another sense, it's still a kind of vernacular because maybe, for example, today, you know, members of that community are like, but no, you know, to the broader and non-African-American English community. And they're like, no, you know, like, this is not for you. So there's still a boundary sort of, you know, drawn. Yeah. And that's where we can see the concept. The key concepts, there's so many different permutations of cosmopolitan vernacular, but the key concepts are cosmopolitanism is meant to bridge a gap, is meant to be to go across boundaries, and vernaculars are typically restrictive. They're typically restrictive of a society. Now, the only thing I want to say to complicate even that idea is that the cosmopolitan, though, there's still a kind of gatekeeping in the pre-modern world, and that's because knowledge is power, right? Literacy is power. So you don't want everyone to be able to learn the language because then you're going to have lots of challenges to your power. So typically there's a tension in great empires between spreading the cosmopolitan language because it makes empire easier. If people can read, then they can read. You can just give them a tax, you know, form, and then they can, you know, you don't have to have like so many people in between to explain it. So it makes running empires easier to spread language.
Wow.
But you want to gatekeep it because you don't want them to become too literate that they replace you. So, for example, in the history of East Asia, in the history of the Sinitic cosmopolitan world, we have a thing called the civil service examination, which was a very difficult exam that you had to take in order to gain entry into the government. And it expresses this tension very beautifully because on the one hand, especially in the early modern period, you know, in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries in Vietnam, it wasn't in fact a place where you could ideally be a farmer and become, you know, a minister at the end. That's the fairy tale, right? You could be a nobody, learn how to read and write, and then rise up to the top of the kingdom. But in reality, it was so difficult that it was a way for aristocrats in power to prevent people from gaining access to power because who's really actually going to be able to learn that? So I know I've said a couple things in mind. Let me just recap in 10 seconds. Cosmopolitan is meant to bridge gaps. It's meant to be a language. It's meant to be a common language across boundaries. Vernaculars are definitive of individual communities. They're restrictive. Now, when we talk about the cosmopolitan, it is meant to bridge gaps, but then the state will sometimes make access to that education so difficult because they want to gatekeep power in society. So this is all great background for understanding the role of Chinese in the history of Vietnam. But does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense. Totally. And I'm as you're talking about all this, I'm thinking about how K-pop is expressed and how rap Viet, you know, is expressed. And they're encoded with these different concepts that you're talking about. But let's move on. And I'm sure we can probably one day get into the idea of rap Viet to talk about that. Yeah, because I think whatever they're doing has the genetics of the Bronx in it. And I don't know who's ever broken it down. And I think talking about that would be very eye-opening to see how modern Vietnam has adopted these ideas from the Bronx.
I would listen to the crap out of an episode like that. And if you found someone who was from that community, who could speak as an artist, oh man, I would love to join that conversation. Hip hop is a little secret obsession of mine, if you did. So anyway, let's save that for a future episode.
This is great. Yeah. Well, I mean, when you think of Ben Z, you know, the rapper Ben Z,
yeah,
you know, his wordplay and his ideas of, you know, rap, and it's like totally modernizing Vietnam and how we use and understand the words and the form of it is, I can imagine it being its own form of gatekeeping in its own weird way when you know how cool you are and the rest of the world around you is trying to catch up to how cool you are, you know, that, and it's a real cool sort of style that these rappers in Vietnam has picked up.
It is. Yeah, it is. And this is a good segue. Like it is a kind of gatekeeping in a sense, but it is, you know, as hip hop has always been going all the way back to its roots, it is an incredible form of empowerment. You know, so like that's the segue, because when you have by this point in history, hip hop and the entire world of hip hop and that language and that mode is prestigious now. It is no longer, you know, like an underdog culture. It is now powerful. It's powerful in the world, and yet it's imprinted with the DNA of empowerment itself. You know, so like then, like if you're in Vietnam, you're in Saigon, you're in Ho Chi Minh City, and like you are looking for a way to express membership in the modern world, you know, beyond the confines of, you know, Quận Bảy or wherever you live, you know, like this is an incredibly powerful cosmopolitan language through which you can exceed the boundaries of your locale, the boundaries of your individual place, and yet do that in a way that is imprinted with your own identity. So that is the way to think about literary Chinese. Literary Chinese back in the Han Dynasty, it is the language of the Yellow River, right? It has this whole history by this point, 1,000 years, literally. It's been written for over 2,000 years, first of all, by the time it comes to Vietnam or the area of Northern Vietnam. But it has about 1,000 years of what we call classical history. And that means thinkers, philosophers, writers, writing in this language that creates a kind of corpus of texts that you really should think about like the Bible. You know, the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, both of them, but even if you just think about the Old Testament, is an accrual of different writings, right? By various authors that then become canonized into this book that then the ancient Hebrews are like, this is holy. Our understanding of God is contained here. So if you think about it, literary Chinese was used by various people over the first 1,000 years, the last 1,000 years BC, you know, the classical period, what we call the Zhou Dynasty. And by the end of that dynasty, in the Han Dynasty, in the Han Empire time, the dynasty that conquered the area of Northern Vietnam, the writings of various people had similarly been canonized into a group of texts that we now call the classics. In Vietnamese, we call them Kinh Điển, the classical texts. This includes people like Confucius, Zhuangzi, Mengzi. That's, you know, Hong Tu, you know, Jiang Tu, all, you know, Meng, all the Tu. The Tu are the masters, right? So all those masters used literary Chinese, and then their writings are coalesced and canonized in the Han Dynasty. So when the Han Dynasty conquers the area of northern Vietnam, they not only bring the technology of writing into Han and the language of Văn Ngôn or Han Văn, but they bring this corpus of texts that they consider to be the sum of all wisdom in the universe. Like, this is the way to understand the universe. It is really like the Bible, you know? And they bring that to the area of northern Vietnam too. And the society that is developing up in the out of the ruins of the Đông Sơn people, out of the ruins of Cổ Loa, you know, in what we now call, at this time, is called Giao Chỉ. That's the province of northern Vietnam in the Han Dynasty. They are taught to revere the classics as the sum of all wisdom in the universe, and it's written in this language. So very quickly, both the corpus of texts and that language itself come to be revered as holy, as truly sacred. You know, and that is a way of understanding why then. And also keep in mind, you're talking about a society that probably did not have that technology before, probably did not have writing before. Of course, there were rich traditions, rich religious beliefs, rich cultural traditions, etc., but not writing, at least as far as we know. So then the introduction of Sinitic writing, Sinitic classical language, and then this corpus of texts, it becomes enshrined in early Vedic history as a kind of religion, you know? And so when you think about the history of writing in Han Văn or Văn Ngôn, you really want to think about it as a kind of religious experience, you know, the role of religion, you know?
Does that make sense? Yeah, it makes sense. I think about the modern sort of internet and the world of connectivity today. And I think about all of these evolutions that we are going through slowly as you're explaining, you know, all the different types of ways to communicate. Are we losing the ability to sort of have the, you know, cultures coming together to clash? And these things are developing, you know, so we're losing this natural ability to evolve?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. You know, I gave a talk to in Singapore, and one of the audience members asked a similar question about AI and AI translation. Like, what is it going to mean for language, or the need to learn language as a kind of meeting point or clashing point between different cultures and different cultural ideas? It was a really smart question. And the background of that question was, well, when you have a generative AI, and especially AI-fueled natural language processing, which is what allows for translation, then you don't actually need to learn language anymore. You know, I'm sure you've seen it. People walk around now with their phones and they just, you know, they just speak into their phone and then they show the Saum driver or they show wherever they are. And so there is, in fact, no exchange of ideas. Like, the computer or the phone is doing that contact for you, which I think is true. If we have universal translators like that, you know, then it's true. One possible outcome is that our individual languages will lose out on what has historically been a great source of enrichment and cross-fertilization. Now, I don't know. I mean, I also think that we just can't imagine yet the things that this type of technology will enable, though. You know, like, in some ways, it of course is a great bridge builder. You know, so maybe with translation and AI, maybe, you know, like, it will in fact do the opposite. It will facilitate language learning because people will want to learn other languages and they will have all these tools to learn them now. And so maybe it'll be the opposite. Maybe it'll accelerate, you know. But I will say it is a truth of reality of the world that when you have cosmopolitan languages coming through, they replace, like, an inevitable outcome is the extinction of other languages, you know, like because you don't need them. Languages are communicatory systems, right? So if you have one communicatory system and you don't need 10,000, well, it's just human then to just lose the other ones, you know? And that is a tragedy. You lose diversity, you lose culture, but it's also a total just practical reality of communication, you know?
John, we have 1,000 other things to get to, but I have to get this one other question in. You know, when I drive around in my city of LA And I see Chinese popping up now a lot of different places. And I think about English, and I think about these two superpowers. And I think how difficult Chinese is to learn because of all of the signs and the symbols that you have to pick up. And there's only 26 that you have to learn in Romanic alphabet in English. Yeah. The adoption and the strangulation and the extinction of English as we know it, is it a possibility because China is growing in popularity? Korean, I feel, is bursting through because of its popularity in films and K-dramas and K-pop. True. But when I think about, like, in another 10 years, where does Chinese and English compete? What's your prediction in terms of who's going extinct? I mean, because we're talking about it, I can't let these things go, but we have so much more to talk about on our list.
It's a fun question. Yeah, I mean, okay, first of all, nothing is impossible. If you look at the history of the world, you'll see that immediately. Like, who speaks Latin? Nobody speaks Latin. I mean, just like four people in the world speak Latin today, you know? And same with French. French used to be one of, the term for cosmopolitan language literally is lingua franca, which is Latin, ironically, for the Frankish language, because French used to be the lingua franca. French used to be the most powerful cosmopolitan language of Europe, and it is absolutely not today.
I always wonder why they called it that, lingua franca. Yeah. I was like, why do they call it that? What does France have to, now I get it, it's clear.
Yeah, and you know, today, unquestionably, we're living still, I would argue, in the Anglophone era, where English is absolutely the most powerful cosmopolitan language. But you are 100% right. Mandarin, specifically, has, first of all, steamrolled across China. I mean, speaking of the extinction of other languages, and has led to the mass extinction of many, many different Chinese languages. I mean, a dramatic example of that is the precipitous decline of Cantonese, which was used to be an incredibly prestigious language, and the incredible rise of Mandarin everywhere in China. And then as a result of that, the rise of Mandarin Chinese around the world. Now, I find it, it's difficult to say whether Chinese will eclipse English or not. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's impossible at all, because as I said a moment ago, anything is possible. But English is still very dominant in many fields, especially, you know, many academic fields, and academic fields trickle down to, you know, fields of different professions and different, I can't think of the word right now, but different practices, right? So I think it would take a long time for English to be rooted out in that way. And also, so many different nations in the world still embrace English as a cosmopolitan or language of learning. So it would take a lot historically for Chinese to replace English in that way. I think, as many others, geopolitical scientists and scholars have said, we're not looking at a shift towards Chinese replacing America or the English world as the singular dominant power, but we're looking at a shift from an American-led, you know, or English and or English-led world to a more diversely led world, you know, where English and Chinese maybe are two sort of modes alongside one another. But who knows, you know, like anything is possible. And one day, maybe in 1,000 years, there will be an Earth government and we'll have a single language. No idea. Yeah. You know? But I will say that the problem that must be solved is the same problem that was faced in the Han Empire, which is people speak a ton of different languages. You've got to run a single state, you know, across this incredible diversity. So how do you do that? Well, you implement a written official language, you know, that is going to be the technology of the state. And that was literary Chinese or literary Sinitic. And it became, and what I was trying to say a moment ago was that, yes, it was a tool of the empire. But as you said, it also was, you know, perhaps unintentionally, was incredible technological benefit to the people. And also it was truly embraced by this hybridized society growing up in Shaoqi in the first, second, third centuries CE, as a really sacred thing. You know, not only did they think of writing as a kind of magic, you know, it was a kind of magical technology. It was powerful in this cultural way, but also the most sacred texts for at least the elites were written in this language. So, you know, reading Confucius, reading Mencius, reading Zhuangzi, it was like reading the prophets, you know? And you wanted to learn how to read literary Chinese, not only because you could advance in the empire, you could advance in Zhaoqi, but also, and make your life for your family better, but also because you were getting closer to the quote-unquote original language of right. The wisdom of the sages, you know? Tanghien, you know, that's the word we use in modern Vietnamese for this group of people who were considered to be the prophets of classical culture, you know? And so over that next whole 1,000 years, from the Han to the Tang Dynasty, this rich, rich tradition of writing in this language, of expressing in this language, grows up. And it truly becomes the native literary language of the region. And that's really cannot be overstated, because the popular idea is that the quote-unquote Vietnamese people are sort of sitting in corners like the rebels in Star Wars, like just waiting to overthrow the evil Chinese Empire. And then the minute they do, they're like, we don't have to learn Chinese anymore. And that's just not right, okay? Yeah. Like, these people are thinking, when they're writing, when they're expressing themselves, they're writing in literary Chinese. They're expressing themselves in literary Chinese. And that's why when we get to the independence period, when we get to the first independent Vietnamese kingdoms in the second millennium, the Li and the Chen, and then the Lei afterwards, all of the literature is written in Văn Ngôn. You know, Chữ Nôm and vernacular Vietnamese develops around that time, but does not become embraced until much, much later. Mm. So this is where I want to give you the example, the very famous example of the poem that is popularly attributed to Lý Thường Kiệt, the great general who fought the Song dynasty, you know, in a series of battles. We don't know who really wrote this poem, but that's who it's attributed to. There's a couple different attributions, but the poem is called Nam Quốc Xuân Hà, you know, and it is sometimes thought of as the earliest proclamation of independence in Vietnam, right? And the poem that is often learned in primary school, you know, is as follows. Can I read it really quickly? It's only 4 lines.
Yes, yes, yes.
Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3 quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, more terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
So it's Sông núi nước Nam. Sông núi nước Nam, vua Nam ở. Dành dành định phận tại sắc trời. Cớ sao lũ giặc sang xâm phạm, chúng bay sẽ bị đánh tơi bời. Okay, so that's Vietnamese language. So maybe you don't know every word in that poem, but you can get the general sense, right? In the among the hills and rivers of the south, the southern king lives. You know, it's very clearly written in the Book of Heaven. Why the hell are you coming over here? We're going to beat the hell out of you. Basically, yeah. That's what it means, right? That poem, those words were not written by Lý Thường Kiệt or any person from the Lý dynasty. That was a translation written by Trần Trọng Kim, a very famous, you know, scholar from the early 20th century. The original poem attributed to Lý Thường Kiệt sounds like this. And you are taught to memorize this in primary school in Vietnam, but you don't know what the hell it means, right? So this is what it sounds like. Nam Quốc Sơn Hà, Nam Đế Cư, Tiệt Nhiên Định Phận Tại Thiên Thư. Như hà nghịch lỗ lai xâm phạm, nhữ đẳng hành khan thủ bại hư. That should not make any sense to you, even if you are a native speaker of Vietnamese. Why is that? Because that is literary Chinese. Mm. What I just spoke is literary Chinese. And when that poem was originally composed, that was the language it was composed in. Now, you might be like a Mandarin listener out there and be like, what the hell? That is not Chinese. Okay. It is Chinese. I could show you the characters. I mean, I can show you. This is a handout from my class. You know, the characters are Chinese. You can't really see it. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the pronunciation system that I read it in is something we call Han Viet, right? Han Viet is a conventional way of reading Sinitic characters that follows a fossilized pronunciation system that was kind of set in the 17th or 18th centuries, but based on the dialect of Chinese that was native to the region many, many centuries earlier. And just a quick shout out to my colleague, Nguyen Dai Co Viet, who wrote a brilliant book about the formation of that pronunciation system. It's called Nghiên cứu Han Viet Thế kỷ 17. So if you have a chance, read this book. It's great. But the point I'm trying to make is that if this poem was written by Li Tengkiat, whoever wrote it in the Li dynasty and was proclaiming to the Song invaders, you stay over there, we're over here. There's a southern emperor and there's a northern emperor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They did not write that in Vietnamese. They wrote that in Han Văn. They wrote it in Văn Ngôn. Why? It's not, as some people say, because they wanted the Song dynasty to understand them. It's in fact because their native literary language, the natural language that they used when they wrote something down, when they expressed something in writing, was Văn Ngôn, was literary Sinitic. It would have been weird to them. It would have felt strange to them to express themselves in any written form of Vietnamese. And if that's hard to wrap your mind around, think about it this way. If you were a kid in Saigon today and you're like, I want to express myself musically, I want to show who I am musically somehow, and the way you feel most natural at doing that is in hip-hop. Hip-hop is not from Saigon, okay? But that may be how you feel is the most natural way for you to express yourself. And that is and it makes even more sense in the Li dynasty, because by the Li dynasty, you've had over 1,000 years of history. That's a long time. Over 1,000 years of history of people thinking that and believing that. Vietnamese or Vietic peoples being like, this is the normal way to write. This is the normal way to write it. So that is one of the main things I wanted to get across in this episode, was Han Văn was the natural way to express yourself in writing for most of Vietnamese history, you know, and you can think of Nam Quốc Son Ha as a way of reminding yourself of that.
I think of these times when I'm walking by my mom's TV set, and you hear certain, and you know, I've dealt with this in talking to other grown-ups when they're talking about Xi Jinping, but then they have a different name in Vietnamese.
Oh yeah.
It's very similar, and I think that
all of, Bing, right?
yeah, and all of the names are sort of like Vietnamese. It's transferred into the Vietnamese way of these, you know, like Peking and Bucking, right?
Exactly.
And yeah. So I'm thinking about that sort of like that systematic way of transferring these phonetics from Chinese to Vietnamese.
Exactly. That is Han Viet. Han Viet. I mean, sometimes it gets kind of annoying to me, like, especially when they do it with Japanese names, because, you know, like, there's just no way to get from the Han Viet of a Japanese person's name to the original Japanese name. Like, you have to have the characters in front of you. But that habit is a good reminder of what we're talking about, because Vietnamese in the 20th century, 19th century, going all the way back, like they thought of it as their native language. And they, like, to a northerner, they'd be like, no, you don't say Beijing, you say Bucking. You know, Bucking is Chuan. Beijing is some weird way of saying it, you know? So that is a good way to think about the idea that Văn Ngôn really was the Văn Ngôn. It was the literary language of Vietnamese peoples until very late in history, when really in the colonial period, when Vietnamese language was elevated to become the national language, the Quốc ngữ of the Vietnamese people. And just as a sort of shout out to our next episode, Chữ Nôm arose. Chữ Nôm is the character script that was used to represent the vernacular Vietnamese language before the alphabet. And it started to develop very early, probably over the Li Chan dynasties, you know, but it was never used a lot, because people thought of it. First of all, it developed as an accident because people were learning to read and write literary Chinese. And by then they were speaking Vietnamese. So they were like scribbled notes to help them learn literary Chinese. And those accrued into a new writing system, which is Chữ Nôm. but people thought of it as vulgar. They thought of it as vulgar. So the proper way to express yourself was in literary Chinese. Noam was vulgar until people started to really find the vulgarity of Noam freeing. And then Noam becomes this super kind of hot, you know, dang hot, as they say. It became hot, you know, like in like the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And the history of Noam, just to follow the theme of this episode, the history of the rise of Noam from being vulgar to being something super interesting and experimental is so similar to the rise of hip hop. Because it was thought of as kind of, you know, low brow, like, you know, don't do it. If you do it, kind of do it in secret. And then it just kind of explodes as this new art form. So that is a thing we can talk about in the next episode. But for most of history, the normal, the natural, the native way of expressing yourself in literature, in literary, in writing, was in Văn Ngôn. So we should really think of literary Chinese as a kind of literary Vietnamese. And if we had time, maybe next time we can talk a little bit about some of the really beautiful poetry that's written in literary Chinese by Vietnamese authors that tends to get forgotten or ignored. But really, this is some of the best Vietnamese literature. And it expresses the spirit and the soul of different moments in Vietnamese history, you know, quite beautifully. So I don't want people to lose out on that part of our history and our culture.
I look so forward to this next episode. And so it's basically, we're going to get into Junom in the next episode and break down the history and its prevalence in that time period.
Hooray. Looking forward to that. That's going to be super fun.
John, this was great today with all the, thank you for letting me get into all these tangents and, you know, letting me travel through these different questions, because we probably can mine this episode for our own tangential sort of episodes down the road, such as hip hop and rap Viet and its adoption in Vietnam.
Yeah, it's like the funnest part. So it's absolutely a blast. Thank you so much, Kenneth.
Thank
Fun
you.
As always.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.